Good evening. This is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My returning guest tonight is writer and professor of creative writing, Philip Hoare. Tonight, we're talking about his book, Oscar Wilde's Last Stand: Decadence, Conspiracy, and the Most Outrageous Trial of the Century. Philip, welcome back to the show. It is always a pleasure to talk to you about your writing.
It's just a great pleasure to be back on your show, Mark.
This is a different kind of book. This is a book based on sort of a historical period or an incident. And I have to say, most Americans are totally unaware of it because it paints a really different picture of Britain during World War I. It's startling. It's weird. There's some really pieces that are so bizarre as to be sort of funny. But when you realize that people were taking stuff seriously, it's not funny at all. How did you come to this story?
When I was writing about this military hospital, this First World War military hospital in my books, which is the history of this huge, massive military hospital, which was very important in the First World War, and people like Wilfred Owen were treated there. It was a big shell shock hospital, partly, so treating what we now know as PTSD. But that drew me into the story of Wilfred Owen and Sigmund Sassoon and this kind of other life to the First World War, which completely, like as you say in your introduction, it just astounded me. I mean, most British people don't know this, you know, that I suddenly was, as I was digging around to how they, as artists and writers, were living through the war, and they were both serving soldiers, but yet Wilfred Owen was going to a cafe in Piccadilly, which there was an opium den above. And, you know, Sassoon was best friends with Robbie Ross, who was Oscar Wilde's first male lover. And Ross had painted his rooms in Piccadilly. He painted them gold in protest against the war. So there's this whole other layer of a kind of decadent world, which is kind of Weimar Berlin before its time. It's kind of, you know, it's like cabaret. I discovered, for instance, 150 illegal nightclubs opened up in Soho alone. So in central London, 150 illegal nightclubs. And, of course, we have the Americans to blame for a lot of this because they're bringing over jazz.
That's right. Blame it all on jazz. Blame it all on jazz, Phil.
They are. And also because Canadian and American troops are both issued with cocaine as a painkiller for emergency use on the battlefield. But they quickly realize there are other uses for cocaine, particularly if you're hanging out with showgirls.
Yeah.
Who equally find it fun. So there's this whole thing about a drug culture, about a drag gay culture. A lot of stuff is getting quite fluid, you know.
Well, that's the positive side of the story.
Yeah, sure, yeah, exactly.
There's a reaction to that story that just blew my mind.
Exactly. That's exactly as you put it, Mark, is that the reaction to this, which is so reactionary as to make the far right of our time look like pussycats.
It's really true. Yeah.
This guy, Noel Pemberton Billings, he becomes a villain. So it's a story of heroes and villains. And the hero is a woman called Maud Allan. She's a Canadian dancer.
You need to write a book just about Maud Allan, by the way.
I know, totally. And she looks so great. She wears she does this vision of Salome dance in a kind of Madonna-like bra and sort of like transparent skirt. I mean, you can see an awful lot of flesh. She trained in Berlin. She's Canadian, but she trained in Berlin. She's working in London, and that immediately makes her suspicious to the far right of the First World War period. And specifically, she performs in a performance of The Vision of Salome on the London stage, and this is really contentious and outrageous. Number one, it's partly based on Oscar Wilde's play about Salome, which is very decadent, sort of dripping in sort of gothic glamour. And she's performing this on stage, but because it involves biblical figures, John the Baptist, for instance, and Herod, it's not allowed to be played in public. There's a prohibition against biblical figures being portrayed on the London stage. But she gets around this by having it as a private club performance. But it's in Sloane Square. It's in the middle of London, and you know, you just sort of become a member for the night. So it's kind of getting round things. And, of course, it's very titillating at the time, you know, and there's, you know, the town is full of soldiers and people who are living under the heavy manners of wartime restrictions. You know, Defence of the Realm Act is banned drinking after a certain time. It's introduced all lots of limitations on people. This is why the illegal nightclubs crop up. This is why this sort of secret, although quite public, performance of Salome comes to the fore. And what happens is that she is used by a rabble-rousing, maniacal, neo-fascist, blatantly neo-fascist, actually, MP called Noel Pemberton-Bedding. And he's a real sort of Edwardian, moustache-twirling villain, you know.
Yeah.
He's like Dick Dastardly. And he has somehow managed to secure a seat in Parliament as an independent member of Parliament. And his shtick is that Britain is losing the war, as we were in 1917. Britain's troops are about to pull out of Europe. You know, things are going really bad for the Allies. Just as the Americans come in, this is quite why that's all so key. He says the reason why British soldiers are losing the war is because their spiritual, almost, their spiritual sense has been sapped by the decadence into which Britain has succumbed.
Well, this is where it sort of totally spirals from ultra-rightist foaming at the mouth to insanity, because they start linking the German enemy with homosexuality and immoral behavior in Britain. So they start saying that the reason the people are acting like this shameful way is because they're influenced by the Germans.
Exactly, exactly. And in fact, the Secret Service claim that the German Secret Service, the British Secret Service, claim that the German Secret Service, or rather this Noel Pemberton-Bedding is saying that the British, there's all layers of propaganda here, that the German Secret Service have a black book containing the names of 47,000 members of the British
Right.
47,000.
And people talked about this book under oath in court as if it was something they had read.
I mean, it's completely nuts. Yeah, so they bring the book. I mean, Binning claims he produces kind of a guy called Harold Spencer, who's a disaffected American officer, and who's actually completely out of his head, to be honest. He's not really very mentally stable. He claims to have seen this book, and he claims that the names of everyone from high-ranking members of the royal family, the prime minister's wife, onwards, all the British establishment are kind of riddled with this perversity, and they are being blackmailed by the German Secret Service. This is why things are going wrong, because they're being blackmailed by the German Secret Service to let Germany win, basically. That's kind of what he's saying. And he fixes on Maud Allan as the kind of the epicenter of this perversion, and he claims she's a lesbian. Well, the thing is, no one knows what a lesbian is.
Well, wait a minute. Let's just pause here, because we've got to slow down, because this story, by the way, I just want to mention, it's exactly as he's telling it. The weird thing for me, among many weird things reading this book, this takes place during World War One. It's long after Oscar Wilde has died. I think he's died 13 years before. Yeah. Yet, the cult, or the fear of an Oscar Wilde cult, and the influence of Oscar Wilde is still running high in Britain.
Exactly. And you put your finger on the key to it. Because the thing is, Oscar Wilde was hugely popular. Hugely popular. He was beloved. The middle class loved him. They, you know, it all actually speaks against what Binning is saying, because actually the middle class, they love a bit of titillating perversity. You know, I mean, it's just kind of a frisson of naughtiness, and Wilde gave them that. And he gave them that in a sophisticated, stylish way on the stage. His name was up on all the theatre marquees. You know, the night that he was arrested, you know, they had to put white paper over his name on the theatre. He was so popular. This is why this is why billing was able to, like, convince people it was a problem, because they thought that all these liberal, you know, members of the Parliament, of course, is a liberal member of a Prime Minister, Herbert Asquith, they're all in it together, you know, and it's really like, but it's so comparable to now. So that they fear the dead hand of Oscar Wilde still on British culture, that he has perverted young men and women. And it's key, is the thing about women is because, of course, lesbianism isn't outlawed under the new homosexual, anti-homosexual legislation of the late 19th century, which is what did for Wilde. So Billing uses Maud Allan as a target. This is how perverted things become. Women are having sex with other women. And, you know, I mean, of course, that's all. No one is disguising the fact that that's a heterosexual male fantasy in many ways, even then. And there's a lot of stuff around that. But Billing is using it in the most extraordinary way. He uses it in a pathological way. So that when Maud Allan sues him, quite rightly, for libel, although she probably is gay, but, you know, she sues him for libel, he produces in court, in the Old Bailey, the same courtroom where Wilde was tried, he produces in court a doctor who claims that a lesbian is a woman who can only be satisfied by a bull elephant. I mean, just what is going on? Then he introduces...
I think the amazing thing is there are people in court who are listening solemnly to this testimony.
Yes, yes, yes. And the other thing, of course, Billing's really drawing on this... he's drawing on people like Magnus Hirschfeld in Germany, the kind of new sexologists. I mean, it's all tied in with Freud. It's tied in with these new troubling sciences of the mind and of, you know, the sense of fetishism and things like that. And so in court, Billing's doctor, the doctor who gets up and gives this evidence, is just as crazy as anyone. He starts talking about the cult of the clitoris.
This is where I just broke up. Because there was a printed article about this, too.
Oh, yeah, it was in the paper. That's why.
And it literally was called The Cult of the Clitoris.
Yes.
And as you write, like, most people in Britain didn't even know what the word meant.
Oh, none at all. You know, there's this possibly apocryphal story that someone goes into a gentleman's club, reads the Daily Times, and says, who's this Greek chap clitoris they're all talking about? The thing is, these people are being faced with the shock of the new.
This is the overarching point of your book. That, and there's a quote from your book I love: "In decadence can be detected the pre-shock of modernism."
I think that's it. That's what, and it shocked me actually to see how much all of this was. And it was all happening just before the First World War as well. That the kind of behaviour we associate with the 1920s, the kind of avant-garde, and some of these clubs are avant-garde art installations. You know, when they have people like Wyndham Lewis and Ezra Pound involved.
Yep, yep.
You know, I mean, Ezra Pound is a key sort of epicenter of modernism. You know, his relationship with T.S. Eliot and James Joyce, all those people, Marianne Moore, and so what this is really, it is really comparable to now, because there's all these things are being lumped together in one thing. You know, modern art, you know, perversion,
right,
liberalism, all these things which are threatening, you know, the dying culture of the empire. The empire is dying.
Well,
these people realize is that this is the last gasp of the British Empire. And this is and that's why they are so worried. You know, they're worried about black people appearing in London, playing in bands. People, you know, that becomes a new pop culture. You know, you have black jazz bands playing in London, and they are a cult, you know. And it's seen as the devil's music, as it is in America, you know. So there's all these threats to their status quo that really, really stir the whole thing up.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My returning guest tonight is writer, professor of creative writing, Philip Hoare, and we're talking about his book. It's a really startling piece of history. Oscar Wilde's Last Stand, Decadence, Conspiracy, and the Most Outrageous Trial of the Century. There was a phrase, kicking Oscar's ghost around that people talked about? Wherever there was a reactionary thing, they would drag up Oscar Wilde again and then bring it up. But the other thing that was very startling is this really dramatic rise of nationalism, jingoism, homophobia, and anti-Semitism. Yeah. I mean, all this goes hand in hand with sort of a repressive government.
Yeah.
And those connections are really, really strong, especially with Noel Pemberton Billing. His paper was called The Imperialist.
That's right. Yeah, and he actually starts together to get a group of people who calls the Society of Vigilantes. And they are young, tough men. He recruits a lot of them from the East End of London. They start roughing up people in the street.
Boy,
people who look Jewish, people who look queer, if they can identify that.
Yep, yep.
Young men who they think ought to be in the army. And this is street violence. This is just like what goes on in Germany in the coming decades, in Britain too, with the Mosleyites.
Yep,
It's a real... I mean, Billing says, at one point, he says that Jewish people should be the last people allowed into the air raid shelters. So you have air raid shelters against Zeppelin attacks. There are a lot of Zeppelin bombing raids over London. He wants Jewish people to be kept aside. He wants them to wear, and this just floored me, he wants them to wear yellow cloth star badges.
Yikes. I know this whole thing is like, and the thing is, we're not just talking about a few people supporting him. A sizable percentage of the British population at that time supported these ideas.
He fills the Royal Albert Hall with an audience, you know, when they have their rallies. You know, people, there are members of the police who support him. Of course, the other thing that, on the other side of this, you've got quite a lot of radical left stuff going on. What a lot of people don't realise is there are general strikes during the First World War in England, in
That's
London.
Right.
The police go on strike. The fire brigade go on strike. In Scotland, they have to bring tanks into the centre of Glasgow to prevent against violence, as they perceive it, from communist agitators. So this idea, you know, all that sense of, you know, this sort of sepia-tinted image of the First World War we have, especially in Britain, I think, as being, you know, patriotism and, you know, it's complete rubbish. It's so much like subversion, insurrection, you know, obviously the suffragettes movement is still going on fiercely. There's a big pacifist movement, people like vegetarians, all like coalescing to oppose the war. Siegfried Sassoon wins the military cross fighting on the Western Front. He's a brave, aristocratic, you know, heroic soldier. He throws his medal into the sea near Liverpool and declares himself a pacifist in an open letter to the Parliament. This is such a big thing, you know, such a big thing. But of course, then Billing says, yes, but he's a Jew as well. You know, so it's made, and people like the Bloomsbury Set, Virginia Woolf, they're all drawn into this story too, because there, a lot of those people are pacifists, refuse to fight. Many people are jailed for pacifism, for being conscientious objectors, you know, and they're treated really, really badly.
Now, I want to just take a break, because this is so grim. The way you write about it, it's totally like you couldn't put the book down, because the story just kept building up to this court case. But I want to talk about Maude Allan, because she was sort of like the palate cleanser after all these idiots. Maude Allan, like I said, you've got to write a book about Maude Allan's life. She was like, first of all, she was like the role of the femme fatale. She reminded me of Theda Bara.
Yes, exactly, exactly.
But her, she had a really dark
just before the silent movies come in, really.
Yeah, but she had a dark backstory. Her brother was a murderer.
Yeah.
And that kept being brought up. Yeah. But she sort of made up all these facts about her life. I mean, she had this incredible backstory about her life to make her seem more exotic. And that was her thing, to seem like this exotic vamp.
Yeah, exactly. She was a very self-created person, you know. The story about her brother is weird because he was executed. He was hanged for a murder, pretty horrible murder. When she played Salome, she had a papier-mâché head of John the Baptist, the decapitated head of John the Baptist. Jesus. And she openly said she was imagining it was her brother when, in the play, she kisses this decapitated papier-mâché head. So there's degrees of extraordinary darkness there, you know. And it really is tying into a lot of stuff that goes on in the fantasy eclat, you know, sort of Nietzsche.
Yep, yep.
Lots of sort of very dark themes, and she's embodying those in a very seductive way. She just looks amazing, and she's a great, you know. And you could buy her postcards of her all over London, you know, all over the UK. These really wonderful images. She looks fantastic, bedecked in pearls. You know, she's wearing virtually nothing, like a kind of a see-through black skirt and this kind of brassiere, but she just looks fantastic. And she'd strike these sort of, you know, voluptuous poses.
But what's weird about this whole story is, even though she's got all this decadent paraphernalia, she's sort of a naif. I mean, she's sort of, she's the naive, and she walks into the middle, essentially, of this mess that's going on in Britain.
Yeah.
And she becomes the lightning rod. I mean, to attract all the forces and a lot of it had to do with her choice of Salome, because Salome, as a play, we were talking about how everybody's still, not everybody, but a lot of people still feared Oscar Wilde.
Mm.
That was an amazing play. And
absolutely, because it overtly sees a sexual relationship between Salome and John the Baptist, also between Salome and her stepfather. There's lots of levels of really charged sexuality going on here. She's really drawing on that. It's very sensational what she does. And of course, there is an entire other level of stuff going on here, because it turns out she's partly being used by the liberals to bring down Noel Pemberton Billing.
That's right.
She doesn't realize it, I don't think.
No, she seems like a pawn in this whole thing.
Exactly. It's a political game, because the Lloyd George and Asquith are scared that Billing is actually gaining power. I mean, that what you were talking about, how large his support, how big his support was, that's starting to frighten them, especially because of all this social unrest, the way the war is going, the war is going really badly. They're actually really worried that Pemberton Billing is going to push for power by any means necessary. And Billing is this great futurist. You know, he designs the first seaplane, the first plane that actually becomes the model for the Spitfire.
And he also makes a movie it's a lost film.
He does. He makes the first election propaganda film, in which he's pushed down the Mile End Road, which is a long road, wide road in the East End of London. He's pushed down the road in his aeroplane. And then he stops the aeroplane and starts making a speech. And he's got this smeared back hair. He wears a rimless monocle, so a monocle without a rim in it, without a metal rim. It's just a lens. He has the doctor make, as a plastic surgery technique, a little ledge on his eye, on his lower eye ridge, as it were, so that the monocle can fit in place sort of permanently on his eye. It's incredible. He's like a kind of, he's almost like almost something robotic about him. You know, it's almost something out of a Fritz Lang movie. And he wears really strange costume he wears. He doesn't wear a tie. He wears something. It's almost like a bootlace tie. Like this big sort of symbol at his neck. He drives a car which is, it's almost like a torpedo, shaped like a torpedo, streamlined. He's like a futurist. He's like Marinetti. You know, he's that whole thing about, you know, the future is machine. It's beyond human.
It's interesting that the futurists had fascist tendencies.
Absolutely. And then there's that, as they absolutely did, right through to Mussolini, you know, in Italy. I mean, that's, you know, but then Marconi was a fascist.
Yeah.
I mean, Marconi, you know, saw Mussolini's, I mean, he became a Mussolini supporter. He saw Mussolini's policies perfectly in line with his inventions, you know. The sense of what technology could do, this is so, again, so current, how technology could control human beings. That was already there, you know, right at the beginning of the 20th century.
We have 2 minutes left, so we're not even going to get into the verdict, because people make people read the book.
Sure.
But what happened to him afterwards?
So he continued to be a member of the Parliament. He was actually physically thrown out for brawling in the House of Commons.
Jesus.
He kept on designing. He actually made a film of his own called High Treason, which is like a British version of Metropolis. So it sees London as having everyone having their own personal aeroplane, you know, like sort of an autogyro. And he, in this film, it's quite amazing, actually, because it does look like Metropolis. He turns London into Metropolis, into Fritz Lang's Metropolis.
We're going to have to stop there, Philip, because we're completely out of time. Cool. I hope people get a sense of the fact that this is a really deeply fascinating and troubling history, and it totally changes your view of what was going on in Britain during World War One, especially for Americans. My guest tonight, my returning guest tonight, is Philip Hoare, writer, professor of creative writing. I love talking to him because the conversations are always, his books are always fascinating. And tonight we've been talking about his history, Oscar Wilde's Last Stand, Decadence, Conspiracy, and the Most Outrageous Trial of the Century. Philip, it's a real pleasure to talk to you again.
It's an absolute pleasure for me, Mark. Thank you so much.
You listen to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.